And then some subtopics under that. How do I fit into it? Where's my place? And we'll explore several avenues there. But we will stop short, and we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk about. And we're going to stop short of trying to get down to the nuts and bolts of this is how you do this and this is how you do that. And there's a very good reason for that. I think that's premature. And we don't want you coming away feeling like you've gotten a hold of some methods that, by golly, you're going to make them work. Because they, if we did give those kinds of things to you, they probably wouldn't fit. And so what we're after this time is to have some things happen right here. It's not getting the right ideas down on paper that will make a difference. It's going through a metamorphosis in our own thinking and what goes on in our own minds. That takes time. It takes concentrated effort. And it's not going to happen just this weekend. If we can open up the windows for you this weekend so that you can begin to think in different directions, there will come a time when you will be seeing the world through a different set of eyes, hopefully through the eyes of the Word of God. I'm going to try to do as little talking as possible. I think that there are better ways to learn than sitting listening to some guy. And so as you flip through these pages here, you'll see that we have a variety of modes of interaction and learning. There'll be times when we'll just go to a discussion, for instance, when we get to the end of this that I'm going to be presenting right now, we'll go into a discussion groups. And then there'll be times when there'll be 2-3 pages in this material, and we'll sit down and we'll just do it individually. You might want to go to your room or stay here or whatever, but I think on 3 occasions we'll just take time out, 45 minutes, get with our Bibles and get with some of these questions and go to work on it, then go into groups, interact on it, come back, have a plenary discussion. And so we'll have a variety of modes of interaction and learning going on here. So, this is informal. If you want to interrupt or make a comment or disagree or reinforce something or illustrate something, that's really what we're here for, too. So we want to keep this as interactive as possible. Okay? Deal? I would feel more secure if we would stop and pray before we got any further. And because I realize that nothing is going to happen here unless the hand of God is on us. And I'd like to ask Erwin, would you lead us in prayer? Save time. It allows you to follow what we're talking about without having to worry about getting things down that you want to retain. And it also gives us, you can kind of tell where we're going and what's going to happen next. I've titled this first session, The 500-Year Storm. The 500-Year Storm has hit us. We Christians hold to some incredible beliefs when you stop and think about it. The fact that God, the creator of the universe, chose to, in space and time, step into this world, live among us, and interact with us. We could talk to him, we could ask him questions. He wouldn't give straight answers very often, but we could ask him questions. We could watch him. When he perspired, we could smell him. He was man, and he lived among us. The tremendous implication for that is that there is truth. Contrary to popular opinion, there is truth, because truth has stepped into our time and space. And then this man turned out to be the Lamb of God. He came to be killed, and he was either him or us. And what this really means, it means an awful lot of things, but what it really means, I think, to me, the overwhelming thing that it means, is that God loves me. Then they buried him. And he got up off the slab one day and walked right out of there. And they rolled the stone away so that people could see that the tomb was empty. They didn't have to roll it away to get him out. He just walked out of there. And but we had to get in. And so we have the empty tomb as a part of history. What that means is that there is eternal life, because Christ demonstrated that there is life beyond this existence. And then this incredible thing where these dozen guys, or 11 because one wiped out, these dozen guys stood there and watched him vanish. And where he went, you find in the last few verses of the book of chapter 6 of Hebrews, where he went was into the inner sanctuary, where he is interceding for us. And what he's really up to is he's guaranteeing your and my position for eternity. Now, when you look at these truths, these things, you have got to say, life can't be the same as it was. There's no way that my human existence could be ordinary in the face of these extraordinary truths. No way. But then we look at life, and it is so ordinary. We face the realities of living in a material world. We have families, and they all like to eat. And they all have to have a place to sleep, and they wear clothes. And so we say, well, somehow or other, I've got to get on with it. And getting on with it means the pressures of taking risks, as many of you men know, what's involved there. Problems of time, the time crunch, cash flow, managing fallen people. And there are all kinds of things that go into just providing the basic necessities of this material world. Then, just some of the things that have happened, we've talked about it already quite a bit, just increasing acceleration and competition in this world where we are trying to make a living so that we meet the necessities of life. The turnaround time has been reduced to zero, and all of a sudden we find ourselves going faster and faster, just trying to stay in place. And Al mentioned yesterday the reordering of our global infrastructure, commerce, capital, and politics. The rules are changing on us, and we're not really quite sure what the new rules are. We just managed to get the old rules figured out, and they're gone, and who knows what's coming next. And in the midst of this accelerated pace, and in the midst of all of this that we're working at, we have this incredible gospel on one hand, and we have the anxieties of just trying to keep up in this modern world, and the two just never seem to meet. And we find ourselves looking at our everyday lives and saying, it doesn't mean anything. And so there's this dichotomy, and we find that we have a loss of meaning. And you ask the average guy what his life really means, and he really can't tell you. He might be a Christian. He might go to church, and he might give you a spiritual answer. Well, my life, I want to follow Christ, and that's meaning, and so on. But to be able to pull those two things together and say, this is what life is all about, very few people can answer. And so in the bottom line of page one, from this famous philosopher, I do my work and then I give some of the proceeds of my prostitution to the ministry. That was my brother. And that's how he felt. We were interacting, the dozen of us, one time and talking about these very things, and that's just kind of how he felt. And what's interesting is that a lot of us laughed, and it was with a kind of a sense of recognition that's the way it is for an awful lot of people. So, but our basic assumption, our being, you know, this little group of guys that invited you, is on page, top of page two, our basic assumption is that commerce and business and the purposes of God are not at odds. God created the material world, declared it good, and put us to work in it. And so business and ministry have got to go hand in hand. Business and our relationship with God have got to be hand in glove. We just don't have it sorted out. And one of the reasons you're here is we want you to help us sort it out. And we think we can benefit from your input, and we think that hopefully you can benefit from ours. But this dichotomy between the spiritual and the material has existed for a long, long time, actually since the Gnostics of the second century, and I'll talk to you a little bit more about them later. You didn't know that Gnostics were relevant to today, but they are. But modern times have heightened this dichotomy that we're struggling with. Modern science promised us a safer, better, happier world, less violence, more wealth, and as we looked at the world and looked at the problems, we said, well, there's nothing that a good, strong economy and more scientific progress and education and some good social programs can't fix. And it wasn't very many years ago, and Lyndon Johnson came out with his talk about the Great Society, and that was kind of the last hurrah of that idea. And now, if anybody came out talking about the Great Society, we would laugh them off the podium, because we know that that's not going to happen. Instead of the Great Society, instead of education and a stronger economy, wealth, and so on, producing a safer, better society, we got the opposite. I read a book a few years ago by Paul Johnson called Modern Times. And in this book, he traces the development of just things in this century. And one of the main points that he makes in the book was that in the 20s and 30s, the prevailing attitude around the world by governments is the way to run a country, the way to run a government, is through totalitarianism. Now, totalitarianism is a very simple way to run a government, because you just get total control over all the people. And it doesn't take very many people to have that kind of control. And all it is, and the argument of totalitarianism is, you've got to punish the innocent. If you punish only the guilty, then the innocent have nothing to fear, and so you can't control them. And so there are some arrests at night, there are some tortures, there are some executions of people that are innocent. You have an island off the coast someplace where you put the people that you're punishing, and they don't have to have done anything wrong. In fact, it's probably better if they haven't, because it's really terrifying when a violence is random. Last month, or in April, I was in Ethiopia. They had 18 years of communism, and everybody I met had his own personal horror story to tell. Like this one gal, architect working in the office there, and she told about how they dragged her dad out in the middle of one night, shot him, and left him in the street. Another guy, Omo, who he's quite an intellectual, told the story of his when he was in college. He was a Marxist, because Haile Selassie was very corrupt, and he saw that was not the way to go, and so he supported the communist cause. But he said that when he'd go to school, he said every once in a while the military would show up and just open fire on the students at random. He said one time one of his buddies, they were hunkered down in one corner, one of his buddies just dropped dead right beside him. And then he said he'd go to school in the morning, and to get the class, they would force the students to step over bodies. And so the militia would get there to school first, shoot a few of the students that got there early, line up their bodies so that you'd have to walk across them to get to class. All they're doing is instilling terror. And so, and you know, in Ethiopia, we probably, some of you guys sent money to buy food for Ethiopia. Well, they didn't need your food and they didn't need your money. There was a drought up in the north, but it was a rebel area, and there was food in the south, but they just ran blockades on the highways so that the food couldn't get there. The food we sent just sat in the docks or was sold off one way or another. And so a million people died of starvation unnecessarily. That's the safer, friendlier world that we are living in. Paul Johnson summarizes his book in the last couple of pages. He kind of sums it up, and he calculates that about 120 million people in this century have died at the hands of their governments. And so we are the most barbarous, this planet is the most barbarous that it's ever been. And our education and our economic progress and everything else has not made us kinder. It has not made us more humane. We're as barbarous as ever. And so we find that our hopes for society, they are not materializing. And we struggle with the disillusionment of that. And we look within our own country and see what's going on, and we struggle with the disillusionment of what we fear is going to come, and rightly so. Then we look on the personal level, and life isn't all that good personally either. We say, you know, we struggle to find 2 hours to rub together. We don't really relate to our own kids very well because we're too busy. And so it just seems that the things that are really important in life, we're having to let slide by because of the rush. And then we look at ourselves as Christians, and we give ourselves low marks on that as well. We say, well, you know, look at the Christians in Rwanda who, you know, are getting hacked to pieces for their faith, or in Nigeria where on regular occasions the Muslims will come in, burn a town, have a few houses singled out that they want to be sure and get rid of some people. They'll burn the churches, burn the towns, drag the people out and hack them to death, and people dying for their faith. Communist China, you know, the tremendous suffering that Christians go through there. And we look at what Christians are enduring around the world, and then we look at ourselves and we say, hey, nobody's trying to kill us for our faith. We've got plenty to eat, we've got plenty of money, here we are. Why aren't we better Christians? And we flagellate ourselves for that. We say we're not the kind of Christians we ought to be. But you know, I've come to the conclusion that the USA, it's a very difficult place to relive the Christian life. I think it's as tough as it is any place in the world. In fact, it's probably tougher to live the Christian life here than it is where you're walking the edge between life and death. Because there are things that are a lot worse than dying. Sometimes living is a lot worse than dying. And it is tough here. And I think until we begin to recognize that it's tough, we're not going to take the kind of measures we need to be the kind of Christians we ought to be. And so, I think the thing that's making it difficult is the kind of transition that we're living in. And we're over on page, we're still on page 2 here, but let me put something up on the transparency if I've got it here. We talk about the 500-year storm. And actually, Western society has been shaped by these four influences. Actually, there might be another one or two, but you know, that's enough for us to go on. The Renaissance, 1490 to 1520, the Enlightenment, which gave the birth of modern science, the Philosophical Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, and the Information Knowledge Revolution. Turn the page to 3, The Renaissance was an absolutely stunning period in human history. In a 30-year period, these men that we have listed here, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, the painter, Christopher Columbus, Martin Luther, and Copernicus, were born. And they were born into a situation, they were born into the period of the Middle Ages, which is a very static, almost unmovable society, where more happens, there's more change that goes on in one day in our world today than would go on in an entire lifetime of a person of the Middle Ages. The average person in the Middle Ages traveled 7 miles in his whole lifetime. One copy of the Wall Street Journal would give a person in the Middle Ages more information than he would get in his lifetime. That is, we get more information in one copy of the Wall Street Journal than a person of the Middle Ages would receive in his lifetime. But these men began to change all that. At the same time, these inventions began to be put into use. The magnetic compass, where you could actually travel in a ship and get out of sight of land and find your way back again. You know, quite astounding, quite unusual. Until then, you'd have to hug the coast, otherwise you'd never get back home again. Gunpowder, which the Chinese had invented mainly for firecrackers to celebrate the 4th of July. But the Westerners figured out how to put it into pipes and turn them into guns and kill one another. And that gave them the edge. You didn't have to be Hercules to win a battle with somebody. You could just shoot him. And that really changed the power structure. Mechanical clock actually, transformed. I wish, sometimes I think I wish I could just throw this thing away and go by the rhythms, the sun and all that kind of the seasons and stuff. Well, that's the way life was for a long time. But it just transformed people's relationship to time and space and everything else. The printing press is an amazing thing that, of course, the West didn't invent it in the first place. Gutenberg put his model together. But some of the things that we take so for granted, the ability to read, the phenomena of reading without moving your lips, that was a novelty. The idea of thinking. And just being able to deal with abstract ideas and so on because of your access to reading just transformed society. Martin Luther, the printing press saved his life. He nailed his 95 theses on the Wittenberg door. People ahead of him that did that kind of thing ended up dead. But overnight, that thesis found its way to England and all through Germany, and he was just too popular to kill. And so it was those kinds of things that produced the kind of change that, that we're experiencing today. I think the most interesting thing that happened in the Renaissance is just what happened to man, where instead of being passive, accepting his fate in a feudalistic society, where the dogmas of the church ruled what went on in my mind, man says, hey, we can grasp our own destiny. It was the beginning of humanism. You look at Michelangelo's work, the one that probably everybody's familiar with, the Sistine Chapel. And here you got Adam, he's got his arm out here, and here's God and his arm out there. I mean, look at the muscles on those arms. I mean, just you look. They really belong on the cover of some muscle magazine. But you'd never have perfection like that. And that's exactly the idea of the Renaissance, is that man it's the promotion of man, that man can take control of his own destiny, that man is in charge. And it was the beginning of the breakup of the monolith that the church imposed during the Middle Ages. And then the travel and trade, it produced a market economy. And that transformed an awful lot of things, because until then, only a landowner had wealth. And all of a sudden, some guy that had no royal blood in him at all would turn up filthy rich because he went out and he sold some spices or something. And so there was a reordering of just the way society was structured through these kinds of inventions. And then the Enlightenment gave birth to two things, the scientific method and the philosophical revolution. Some astonishing things happened, like Copernicus, who discovered that the Earth moved around a sun, created a whole new perspective on the universe. It was a new cosmology, and I'll talk about what that did to us in a minute. And then Isaac Newton, just a quantum leap in our understanding of the universe when he discovered that the Earth and the planets are controlled by gravity. And so calculus was really born. Francis Bacon, who affirmed just the fundamental notion of modern science, is that knowledge comes from observing and measuring the material world. And this resulted in a philosophical revolution where man said, I can reason it out. I can figure it out. And just give me the opportunity to observe the natural world, and we'll have answers for life. And there was tremendous faith at that time that science would give us answers to everything that we were searching for, and utopia would come in. Then the Industrial Revolution came in the mid-1600s. It produced a reordering of the social world. It was things were rural until then. All of a sudden, people flocked to the cities to get jobs in factories. There was urbanization, and you had a new kind of wealth again, and you had a new kind of poverty, because all of a sudden, people totally dependent on a salary or income, unemployment became really disastrous. Whereas in the countryside, at least often you'd have something to eat if you were poor. Other factors, the assembly line, factories, smokestacks, these are the things that characterize the Industrial Revolution. Mass production, mass consumption, mass education, mass media, mass religion. And we bought into the idea that if something is successful, it's going to be big. Big is good, bigger is better. And if a little bit of gasoline will start a little fire, a whole lot of gasoline will start a bigger fire, and that's the way our society has gone. The definition of success is bigness. Well, and the rules of making money, the next three things, cheap labor, raw materials, capital. If you had that, you could build a factory, and you could make money. Transformation in the family structure. In the agrarian society, everything happened in the home. That was where your work was. You went out in the field. That was where your education was, because there were no schools. You'd get educated at home. That's where that was the social center of the day. You know, that's where your recreation took place. So everything happened in the home. It was the extended family. Well, when you know everybody moved to the city, they left grandma and grandpa back on the farm, and so there was a restructuring of the family. And when people got sick, you couldn't take care of them. You sent them to the hospitals. You send your kids to school. Send the elderly to nursing homes because you had to keep moving on that job. And then came the technological revolution. About 1955, the computer, the commercial jet, and birth control just began to set people loose in a way that they had not experienced before, allowed things to happen, diminished the size of the world enormously. Then in about 1985, I remember that was the first time I began to, or 84 or somewhere, and I heard about a fax machine. I remember asking a guy, what's a fax machine? And it's really only been in the last 10 years that these things, fax, email, information highways, satellite dishes, and so on, really moved into use. And so this is incredibly recent. And so, as Al pointed out yesterday, content or knowledge and information is power. It's the basic raw material for the new era. It's unlimited. And then a strange thing where In the industrial society, the idea was massification. Now the notion is customizing. What is it you would like? What product would you like? We'll have that fixed just for you. We'll program it in, and we'll have something that's just tailor-made for you. And so we're moving away from the massification, and that has tremendous implications. Home is changing. Single parents, remarried couples, childless couples, and like in a lot of places, half the households. If you take a census, half the households have only one person living in them. People have moved more in the direction of really living insular lives. You have a return to the home in the cottage industry, 30 million people working at home, and homeschooling, that's increased. And so then just things are speeding up because we have the ability to speed up. Perry and I have a friend who is an architect, and he's always been busy, even in the lean years when nobody was building anything. And I remember asking him one time, I said, how do you stay busy? And he says, well, he said, it's really not all that difficult. He says, every year the government publishes a book of projects that they want to accomplish. He says, it's that thick. And so he says, we go through that book, decide which projects we'd be interested in, and then we prepare a bid and submit it to the government, and the government responds, and he says, we got more business than we can handle. And I said, well, what goes into preparing the bid? And he says, well, sometimes the bid will be several books that thick. And he says, but the way we do it, he says, we start out and begin to work on it, And then at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we fax the whole thing to, and he gave it the name of a city in India, where we have an office, and they go to work on it. It's morning there, they go to work on it. And then at 5 o'clock in the afternoon there, they fax it on to London. And they continue to work on it. And then at the end of the day, they'll fax it to New York and then back to Houston. And so he says, we're working on it around the clock. And so he says, we just have the edge. And so what you've got is a borderless world. And so there's a whole other way of looking at doing business. I put the word, borderless word, Tiananmen Square. It could be anything. I don't know why I put Tiananmen Square there, but just the illustration that China did not get away with Tiananmen Square because there were people there faxing the information to their friends in Canada and the USA, the Chinese people that were passing that on. And who knows, when I think the returns are in, we're going to find that this technological age, the information flow, had a profound influence on what happened to the Soviet Union. And I think one of the things that's going to be interesting is to see what all of this does to a religion like Islam that totally depends upon going back to the traditions and adhering to the traditions for its survival. There's no way that you can keep your traditions intact when you have satellite dishes beaming 500 programs into your country and you can't control it. And so I think that what we're going to see is continued upheaval around the world as these things begin to have their effect. Toffler's thesis, the third wave. I remember reading The Future Shock. I think he wouldn't need to publish it, 1970-something. And when you finish reading the book, you could just feel his neurosis. Because what he was saying was, we're going to go to bed some night and get up in the morning in a world that's different than the one we went to bed in. And he was saying, I'm not sure I can handle that as a human being. I don't know if I can handle that kind of whiz, that kind of speed, that kind of thing happening. And then in his next book, The Third Wave, he divided up the last 8,000 years into these three periods: agricultural society, which is characterized by the hoe; industrial society, which is characterized by the assembly line; information knowledge society, which is characterized by the computer. And so really what we're dealing with, and as has been said several times here, is not just... some minor adjustments, but we're really dealing with a change of paradigm, where there's a whole other way of looking at life, and looking at the way we live life, the way we relate to one another, the way we relate to the material world. And I think this has the world, full of anxiety. Fast world, fierce competition, where a product, a company, or a person can become obsolete overnight. I think, what was the number you gave yesterday, Al? 30 million ex-middle managers unemployed? Is that the number? Yeah. There it is. I mean, there you have, there are the victims of this kind of transition. Where a simple product like a shoe involves global markets. Not too long ago, there was a report came out on the guy that built up Nike shoe. What's his name? Almost sounds like Nike, but it showed that the shoes that he manufactures cost about $2 a pair, and manufactures them someplace in Bangkok, gathers the material from all over Asia, and I think the last pair that we bought, Steve, $120, something like that. Something like about $120, something like that, for a $2 shoe. Well, somebody's making money. What we've got here is there's we have a global thing going on, and the parts, the countries, the entities that we thought were in place forever, like nations and governments and everything else, they're just being overrun. And so in business, we have some new buzzwords, and they're all scary, aren't they? Takeovers, buyouts, downsizing, early retirement, retraining, re-engineering. And so all of that spells insecurity or obsolescence. Now, what I've said so far just summarizes the societal changes. This is what is going on. But I think more important is for us to understand what is happening in our minds and what this is doing in the way we think. And you've got a little diagram there at the bottom. Let me develop that a little bit further. When all this started, let's say at the end of the Middle Ages, religion was king. And really society was controlled by the dogmas of the church. And you didn't have to decide whether you were going to be a part of the church or not. You were born into it. And you'd better pay your dues or you were in trouble. And there was punishment attached to non-participation. And, as time wore on, I mean, it's not a very happy story. But theologians would quibble over minor points of doctrine. They'd burn each other at the stake over a question like the true nature of the soul. And so, it's not that these were the good old days. These are pretty tough days for an awful lot of people. Well, then science came along, the basic assumption of science was that you can observe, you can learn about the world, you can gain truth by looking at nature, because God created nature in an orderly way. He created the world in an orderly way, and an orderly God would make something that you could observe and draw conclusions on. And the founders of modern science were devout men of God. Isaac Newton, we still sing some of his hymns. And you had, men like John Locke, just another, man of God. Galileo, also, a devout Catholic. But these men, as they began to use the scientific method of observation, they found that they couldn't have the theologians in the same room with them as they worked in their science. There's this one play. I don't know if it's true or not, but I think it is, about Galileo. And he was trying to show the theologians that the earth moved. And they were convinced that it didn't. And he was trying to show them that it did. And so he had everything set up. He had his telescope set up. So all you'd have to do would be to look through the telescope and you could see the planet move. And so he had these theologians there, and they were the men of the church, and he said, now just look through there and you'll see that the planets move. And they said, well, we don't have to look. Well, why not? Well, because the Bible says that the earth does not move. And they were quoting from Psalm 93, where it says, the world is firmly established, it cannot be moved. And so, on that basis, they said, you know, it's already decided. The earth does not move. The Bible says so. And so he never did get those guys to look through that telescope. And so then he faced the Inquisition and the threat of death. And so they said, you either recant or you go through the Inquisition. And so he recanted, but then under his breath, as he was recanting, he says, but it does move. And so the problem here is that the division between, there was a rupture between religious and science. The scientists, even the Christian science, you know, the believers, they says, we got to get these guys out of the room because we can't think as long as they're there. So then what happened was science became the authority, where before, religion was the authority. But and the hope was that science would instruct us and would give us the answers to the big questions. But then something happened here which produced a rupture between science and reason. Yes? No.
Scientific method.
Yeah.
And what became science was not actually the scientific method. It was, I mean, it became its own, like, institution.
Right.
That went beyond the scientific method and analysis.
Yeah, that's a good clarification. Because I'm not saying biblical, this is not the equivalent of biblical truth. This is the system. This is the institution. And here were some men that were trying to work it out. They could not cope with the institution. Now, science then also became an institution with the hopes that we would have answers to the big questions. So that's kind of what you're saying. And I think that's important to clarify, because to think that there is a split between biblical truth and, you know, reason or science or whatever, you know, that would be misleading. But there was also a break then between science and reason. Copernicus pointed out that the Earth is just one more planet in the midst of many. His theory was that the Earth revolved around the Sun. The Sun was the center of the universe. People have corrected it since then. But this dealt a blow to the theology of the day, because that said that the earth is not the center of God's creation. That's the way they interpreted it. And so that shattered that idea. Well, then Darwin came along, and he said that man is not special. Man is just one more creature on the evolutionary chain, perhaps higher than the others, but he's just really one more beast. Well, that did away for a lot of people with the notion that man is the prime piece of art in God's creation, and the uniqueness of man, the sense of the uniqueness of man was lost. Then Sigmund Freud came along, and he said, "Your well-reasoned arguments, these things that know, you put forward, even in your scientific method and so on. He said, all they really are is a cover for, he talked about the id, the ego, and the superego, and the id is the subconscious, the undefined. And he says, it's just the primal urges that come out of you. And these drives, and a lot of it was sexual in his vocabulary. But our well-reasoned objective arguments, they're nothing but a cover-up for these subjective urges that really are the things that drive us in society. And so the conclusion is that reason isn't going to get us there. The mind isn't even a reliable mechanism for us to judge reality. And so what happened was where we hoped that reason would be the thing that would help us hold it together, we found that reason really broke with everyday life. And reason really doesn't have anything to do, in a sense, the position today is that what does reason have to do with it? What does reason have to do with the way I live? Because after all, there isn't any truth. So you bring me your well-reasoned arguments, but I feel like doing something else. So I'll go with my feelings. And I could give you endless illustrations of that, just in the people that I'm involved with. But what this does to us as a society is that we are not even in a position to deal with the most elementary issues. Abortion. How are we ever going to settle that question if this is where we are? Where reason, where science does not really instruct us, where man is just one more creature, and where he's nothing special, then there is really no reason for us to say abortion is wrong. I say a man is created in God's image, that a fetus is a human being. You say, no, it's just one more biological accident, which we can end at will, because there are no higher causes to it. It's a standoff. It's us guys against you guys. And who's going to decide? Euthanasia, you know, the killing of the elderly. That's the next one to come down the road. It really began in Holland. I don't know if it actually began there, but they're the ones that are furthest advanced in it. And the basic rationale is where a person is terminally ill, and there's no hope, and they're in pain, let's assist them in their death. Well, they've been doing that for a couple of decades. Today, over 50% of the euthanasia cases where people are put to death, neither the patient nor the family have any knowledge of it. It's a unilateral decision by the doctors. So that's where it's going to go. And why not? If we conclude that man is nothing more than just one more biological accident, and if we conclude that there is no truth, then whatever just seems to make sense at the time, that goes, and who's going to argue with it? I mean, it happens very close to home. Just last year, about this time, there was a 57-year-old Air Force colonel, retired, driving down the highway in the morning up on I-25. You can probably throw a rock and hit it from here. And he had an altercation with a high school kid, 17, 18 years old. There, he was on his way to school. And one cut the other one off, and they began to give each other, you know, hand signals of various kinds. And so they motioned to pull over, and the kid pulled over, the guy pulled over. The kid got out, walked back to the car where the colonel was, and punched him in the face. The colonel pulled out a .357 Magnum and blew him away, shot him in the head, killed him. Had extra ammunition in the car. You know, he was going to just, you know, in case this kind of thing happened, well, he wanted to really be ready for it. And you know, there he was. Now, the irony of it is he went to court, went to trial, and got off. About the same time, August of last year, there was a guy in Chicago that killed a rat in his backyard that was eating his vegetables. And he was charged and had to go to court for killing a rat in his backyard for eating his vegetables. Now, we can't sort out the difference between a kid and a rat. And that's where we are. So the question, gentlemen, is how do we swim in these waters? See, this is where it is, and this is where it's going, into this kind of confusion and this kind of chaos. How are we going to pull it together? In our own personal lives, let's not worry about society, but you know, where family, business, everything else is changing the way it is, and the very way, the way people think, that's the thing that's really happening. It's the way people think that is being transformed. People do not think the way they did 10 years ago. Values are being changed profoundly. And so we started out, we talked about the gospel and the beauty of the gospel. And then we want to live lives. How do we aspire to live lives and run businesses that are integrated around Christ? How are we going to swim in these waters? Is it even possible? Okay, we're going to take some time. Next, I think there's a coffee break over there now, isn't there? Yeah. Let's take a coffee break.